Good morning. Welcome to the press briefing of the Information Service here in Geneva. Today is Tuesday, 8th of October. I want to apologize for my voice. I guess this is the season of the flus. Let's start immediately by hearing the update on the Council from Pascal.
Thank you, Alessandra. Good morning, everyone. First, I want to apologize because last Friday I lied to you twice. I mentioned that the additional report of the fact-finding mission on the Sudan will be released yesterday. It will actually be published this coming Friday. And I also mentioned that the request for the renewal of the mandate of the Special Rapporteur on Climate Change was for an additional year, but it's actually for 3 years, so apologies for that. This morning, the High Commissioner will give an update on the human rights situation in Ukraine. This update is based on the findings of his office quarterly report, the one that Liz Trussell briefed you on last week. And in the afternoon, Volker Turk will update you on the situation in Haiti based on the report that Ravina presented to you last month. His designated experts on the human rights situation in Haiti, William O'Neill, will also participate remotely to this meeting. He recently conducted a mission to the country, a two-week mission there. And then you will hear a presentation of the Secretary General's report on Cambodia and another OHCHR report on Yemen. Resolutions and amendments for this 57th session. So as mentioned to you last Friday, we have a total of 37 draft resolutions. The Council Secretariat also received seven amendments yesterday for resolutions pertaining to Venezuela, youth and human rights, and climate change. And we expect also three additional oral amendments by Cuba on the resolution on Venezuela. So action on these draft resolutions will begin tomorrow afternoon and will continue until Friday. I'm very sorry I don't have yet the running order for this for the consideration of these resolutions, but I'll share it with you as soon as I have it. And as you're all aware, we have important elections coming up on the other side of the Atlantic. Tomorrow on Wednesday at 10 a.m. New York time, the UN General Assembly will elect 18 members of the Human Rights Council to serve a three-year terms starting on January 1st, 2025. There are actually 19 candidates for 18 seats. So let me just remind you who the candidates are. Benin, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Ethiopia, Kenya, and the Gambia for the African group. Cyprus, the Marshall Islands, Qatar, the Republic of Korea, Saudi Arabia, and Thailand for the Asia-Pacific group, Czechia and North Macedonia for the Eastern European group, Bolivia, Colombia, and Mexico for the Latin American and Caribbean group, Iceland, Spain, and Switzerland for the group of Western states and other states. So a reminder that a simple majority of the 193 member states of the UN, which is actually 97 votes, are necessary to be elected as a member of the Human Rights Council. And if there are more candidates in a regional group than the number of allocated seats in this group, the candidates who get the highest number of votes and at least 97 votes will get elected. And unlike other elections, you will get the results quite early in the afternoon around 5 p.m., so you won't have to stay late. And the President of the General Assembly will announce the results. It will be a webcast election. Thank you.
Thank you, Pascal. Is that a hand, Nina? No. So I'll go to the platform. Emma has a question for you.
Thanks, Pascal. I just wanted to ask a bit more about the fact-finding mission report. What is this report called, and what will it look at? Because I thought we already had that report. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I don't have the details yet on the content of the report, but it's an annex to the main report that the fact-finding mission presented to the Council at the beginning of this session. Usually when, you know, the reports, the official reports that are presented to the Council has a world limit, and if an investigative body wants to provide additional information, it then issues what we call a conference room paper, so which is an annex to the main report in which you find more details, mostly statistics, figures that they could not include in their main report. But we'll have most likely a press release that will accompany the release of this additional report.
Thank you. Any other question for Pascal? Also, that was a hand. Nina.
On that, so will we get that under embargo in advance, or is it, will it just be published?
I'm not sure. I will check with my colleague, Todd Pittman, if we will have an embargo version shared with you. So I'll let you know.
Yeah, Jamie.
Hi, Pascal. How common is it to release a report of the fact-finding mission on the last day of a council?
I don't know, but, you know, investigative bodies are facing a lot of issues, including the liquidity crisis, so it hasn't been an easy moment for them to conduct properly their investigation on time, but the fact-finding mission is also expected to present a report to the General Assembly later in October, so they want to make sure that at least this annex to the report is shared with the member states before the end of this session. Yeah.
No other hands? I don't see any. So, Pascal, thank you very much. So let's turn now to the first subject, the first topic of this morning, which is indeed Lebanon. We have a couple of colleagues online from Beirut to brief you. We have with us Matthew Hollingsworth, the WFP country director in Lebanon, and Tariq, who is connected, also has brought us Ian Clark, who's the deputy incident manager for Lebanon, who's also in Beirut. So we will hear from both colleagues now before we open the floor to questions. Matthew, would you like to start?
Thank you very much, and good morning to everybody. Clearly, we are facing extraordinary times in Lebanon currently. Not that we're not expected, unfortunately, and for some time we knew this escalation would be coming in place. But what is happening and has happened over the past few weeks has been astonishing in its significance in terms of destruction and the speed in which people have been displaced. We have upwards of 1.2 million people affected now by this crisis, hundreds of thousands of people displaced from the seven districts in the frontline areas of the south of this country bordering Israel, and of course the southern suburbs of Beirut, emptied, and many of these towns, villages, and suburbs now little more than rubble. We have, in this fast-moving emergency, now seen, horrific cases of forced evacuation notices coming out with few hours for people to prepare and depart. So many of the families that were displaced over the past year, who have prepared themselves, taken their family belongings, are far, far better off than the much greater majority today who have left, in some cases, with only hours to spare before their areas have become under bombardment. And so we're seeing families in shelters. There's now 973 formal shelters inside Beirut in the north of the country, with more than 200,000 people living there registered. 773 of those shelters are absolutely chock-a-block full. These are shelters that were typically schools or academies or government buildings, where there's insufficient, toilets and bathrooms and infrastructure to cope with the sheer numbers who are now living there 24/7, as opposed to the children or students or workers who would normally only be there for a number of hours of a day. Many of the families that I've met, and I was in the south of the country earlier last week, talk about the fact that they are moving not just because of fear of destruction of their land and their homes and their neighborhoods, but also because they've lost people. They've lost family and friends and communities, and they are extraordinarily fearful of what comes next. Trauma, in terms of mental as well as physical trauma, is key to this. People have watched over the last year as the war in Gaza has continued and neighborhoods have been decimated and pounded over and over and over again. And that is deep in their gut, in their hearts, in their minds when they move on. What are we trying to do about all of this? Well, we have been from the very first days able to reach around 150,000 people each day with hot meals, with ready-to-eat rations, sort of a 5-day to 15-day rations, depending on people's ability to cook, fresh bread, sandwiches, and indeed, very importantly, in Lebanon, in this environment, cash transfers. So 150,000 people helped daily at the moment, but that needs to increase. We are always playing catch up because we need to be reaching, at this point, almost 1 million people per day. Right now, we've distributed 500,000 hot meals being prepared through 10 kitchens, as well as those other forms of aid and assistance as well. But there's massive work to be done. 200,000 people in formal shelters. There's many, many hundreds of thousands of more living in informal sites, unfinished buildings, falling down buildings, and indeed, unfortunately, sleeping out rough. Currently, the weather's good. Last night, it rained. Every night, we hear explosions as missiles land in the southern suburbs. Agriculture-wise, food production-wise, extraordinary concern for Lebanon's ability to continue to feed itself. 1,900 hectares of agricultural land have been burned in the south of the country over the past year, primarily in the last few weeks. 12,000 hectares of farmland in what is one of the most productive areas of the country have been abandoned. 46,000 farmers impacted heavily by this crisis. Olive harvests in the south will not happen. Bananas, citrus harvests will not happen. Vegetables rot in fields. And a country that is already dependent on imports has a harder time because what they could provide for their own food security and food system needs is being decimated in the south. We have very significant needs moving forward. Over the next 3 months, as I said, we are building up to reach at least 1 million people who have been impacted, working within a system of organizations that provide food systems and food security support. We have a funding gap of $115 million over that time. We believe starting to receive positive pledges against that, but we're at the moment we are working based upon the anticipatory action, the preparedness we put in place, thankfully funded by some of our key donors ahead of the escalation, where we were able to pre-position some food around the country and put some cash aside for emergency transfers. Key messages right now are clearly de-escalate. De-escalate, de-escalate. Diplomatic, political solutions must be found because the significance of the humanitarian need in a country that has already been racked by accumulated problems over the last few years, not least the economic crisis, but also the fragility that comes from hosting the equivalent of 25% of their population in refugees. And really a country which is already on its knees and that cannot cope with an extended period of crisis such as we're facing right now. The country is tired, people are scared, the trauma is palpable, and obviously we're all concerned that what started a year and a day ago with those horrific events in Gaza now will continue into what could be a more regional crisis. Let's prevent, and de-escalate. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Matthew. And now I'll go to WHO. I don't know if Tariq, you want to say something at the beginning or we go straight to Jan?
Thanks, Vasek. Let's go straight to Ian.
Ian, go ahead. So you are the deputy incident manager for Lebanon for WHO, and you're calling in from Beirut.
Yes, that's correct. And apologies from the WHO country representative, Dr. Abdi Nasir, who's not able to join to other commitments, but he's asked me to give a short statement on his behalf and then to stand ready to take questions. So, I mean, WHO, it's deeply concerned by the impact of the recent escalation of violence on health systems in Lebanon, including the rising number of attacks on healthcare workers and facilities. Since September the 16th, attacks on healthcare have recorded, leaving behind 65 deaths and 40 injuries among health staff. Health facilities have been greatly impacted. More than 96 primary healthcare centres and health facilities have been forced to close in the south due to the rising hostilities. Five hospitals were reported non-functioning, either due to physical or infrastructural damage, and an additional four hospitals have been partially evacuated and have required the transfer of patients, including critical dialysis and cancer patients, to other hospitals while continuing to try to maintain emergency services, albeit with very limited capability. With the present rising tensions in the south and across many parts of the country, including in the suburbs of Beirut, Lebanon has witnessed a sudden and massive displacement, with an estimated 165,000 people becoming internally displaced in a single week. And as Matthew had mentioned, in many cases, these are people who have left their houses, their homes, within minutes of being warned, and therefore have left everything behind, their chronic, their critical medicines, their whole coping mechanisms. As the number of displaced people increases and the population is left with limited access to emergency and to trauma care, as well as to access to essential health services, including routine vaccine and essential child and maternal healthcare services, we're facing a situation where there is a much higher risk of disease outbreak, such as acute watery diarrhea, hepatitis A, and a number of other vaccine-preventable diseases. It's important to remember that Lebanon's health system has been impacted not just in the last few months, but by years of economic and political instability. Over the past 5 years, Lebanon has suffered the departure of a large number of its health workforce, limitations in essential health supplies, expensive out-of-pocket services, and a lack of steady access to electricity, impacting service delivery. All of these challenges have deepened the risk of disease and poverty, which go hand in hand. We cannot ignore that Lebanon is also host to the highest number of refugees per capita, including an estimated 1.5 million Syrian refugees and at least 11,000 refugees of other nationalities. The compound effect of economical challenges, instability, migration, displacement have resulted in significant challenges for health system and its ability to deliver. Despite the challenges, WHO continues to support the Ministry of Public Health of Lebanon in response to the rising IDP challenges. WHO is working with the Ministry of Public Health and partners to conduct a rapid assessment of the IDP's access to healthcare to better mainstream essential services. The assessment is ongoing in parallel with work to support the Epidemiological Surveillance Unit as the Ministry of Public Health looks to expand and improve early warning surveillance capacities, especially at the IDP shelters. Special attention is given to the detection of acute watery diarrheal diseases and vaccine-preventable diseases, lice and scabies, among other potential outbreak threats. Surveillance is also enhanced through the continued support to reference laboratories to the delivery of stocks and of testing agents. WHO is also supporting the ministry through the procurement and delivery of essential medical and surgical supplies. Since the escalation of violence in September, WHO has procured over 116 metric tons of supplies, including surgical trauma supplies, enough to perform 4,000 surgical interventions, and cholera and mental health medicines, enough to treat around 100,000 patients. WHO is also supporting with the coordination of the deployment of emergency medical teams to help to train and capacitate local surgeons at the referral hospitals. Nevertheless, the needs keep mounting as the war goes on. And as Matthew mentioned, The only solution is de-escalation and peace. WHO will continue to work to respond to the emergency whilst we also advocate for peace and for health for all. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And before I open the floor to question, I would just like to call the attention of our reporters on a joint statement that we've just distributed and which has been issued now by the UN Special Coordinator for Lebanon, Janine Hennis-Plaschert, and the UNIFIL Head of Mission and Force Commander, Lieutenant General Haroldo Lazzaro. In this statement, the two officials say, 1 year, and I quote, 1 year since daily exchanges of fire commenced across the blue line, initiated by Hezbollah propelling rockets into Shaba farms in violation of the cessation of hostility and Security Council Resolution 1701. 1 year in which far too many lives have been lost, uprooted and devastated, while civilians on both sides of the blue line are left wanting for security and stability. 1 year in which our repeated appeals for restraints, the protection of civilians, and adherence to international humanitarian law, a return to the cessation of hostility, and a political process anchored in their implementation of 1701 have gone unheeded. There's more in the joint statement, which concludes by saying that further violence and destructions will neither solve the underlying issues nor make anyone safer in the long run. Quite the opposite, a negotiated solution is the only pathway to restore the security and stability that civilians on both sides so desperately want and deserve. The time to act accordingly is now. And you have the full statement in your mailing box. And I would like to also ask, if possible, Tariq and Ishita, who is on the line too, to send the journalist the notes of our two briefers. So let me now open the floor to question in the room. I'll start with Nina Larsson. Nina is our correspondent of AFP.
Yeah. Thank you for taking my question. I guess questions for both of you and also others who might be online. Sorry. Is that me?
There is some computers who are open. I could ask colleagues of checking their computer or telephone, please. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, no, my question was about the attacks or the strikes near Beirut Airport and the calls to avoid hitting the airport. I'm wondering what impact it would have for delivery of aid if that airport is hit, and also sort of in terms of human rights. Maybe I think Jeremy's online. If he could say something about the strikes in Beirut and around the airport and how that. Yes, thank you.
Okay, so just let me know who would like to take this one. And as Nina said, we do indeed have Jens, Jeremy, and James online. So just show your hand. I'll give you the floor. I don't know if Matthew or Ian would like to take this up. Actually, I can't see Matthew on the line. Ian?
Can you see me?
Oh, yeah, now you can see you. Go ahead.
Thank you. I mean, we throughout the last few weeks, we have consistently asked that, unlike, for example, in 2006, in the summer war, we do not see these critical corridors for assistance close. So the airport is very important for the delivery of humanitarian assistance, but also for the movement of humanitarian and emergency medical teams in and out of the country as well. So it's also important because it's a conduit to allow people to leave if they wish to evacuate themselves. So it's important that the airport remains open. It's absolutely critical the ports remain open. And it's also critical that the overland corridors into Lebanon remain open. This is a country that relies on imports to cover most, if not all, of its needs in terms of fuel, in terms of food, and in terms of other materials. If it stops, the country doesn't produce enough and does not have enough in stock to keep managing hospitals, to run generators, electricity, heating as the winter comes in, the movement of goods around the country, aid and assistance and aid workers. So they are all critical entry points for materials, aid workers, emergency management, medical teams, and others. So they are vital.
Jan, anything to add?
Yeah, thanks. Maybe just to add on the kind of the human impact. I mean, you know, over the last week or so longer, the attacks, you know, pretty much begin late afternoon, early evening, and run on right the way through the night at a kind of a regular phase. And of course, this has a massive impact on the, as Matthew mentioned, on the mental and psychosocial health of people. I was just literally this morning visiting a couple of the displacement centers just outside to the north of Bahia. And, you know, people are now sleeping mainly during the day because they cannot sleep at night because of, you know, the blast, the buildings shaking. And this will have a long and lasting impact on people's mental health, children, you know, all night being awake with these explosions. So the psychosocial impact, let alone to the physical infrastructural damages, even for people who have moved and are in, we would hope, a safer area, they are still exposed to the psychosocial impact of the attacks and the bombing. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Jeremy, would you like to answer or to make a comment following Nina's question?
If yes, can, thanks.
You're there. Yeah, go ahead.
So we would always revert back to the paramount importance of international humanitarian law, and that is the three principles, so your distinction, precaution, and proportionality. But moreover, I would say that the importance here is that all parties must respect not only civilians but civilian objects. As our colleagues from WFP and WHO noted, the attacks on whether it be medical facilities and the like. Just over yesterday, we even heard of 10 firefighters killed in a strike in the south of Lebanon. It's imperative here that in the conduct of military operations, constant care is taken to spare the civilian population, civilians, and civilian objects.
Thank you very much. I'm looking at the room. I've got plenty of questions online, but that's is a hand, Jamie. Okay, Jamie Keaton, Associated Press.
Thank you. Yes. I wondered, my question is for Mr. Hollingsworth, particularly Mr. Hollingsworth. You mentioned a lot of numbers, and I appreciate that. Thank you very much. I wanted to just make sure I understood you mentioned that the goal is to have 1 million people helped per day. I didn't quite understand what the current level is on that in terms of getting to reach 1 million. I mean, just in comparison to what the current state of play is. And then the second question has to do, you mentioned also that 1,900 hectares of agricultural land have been burned in the south. Could you put that into perspective? I mean, I was doing the maths as we spoke, and that looks like about 20 square kilometers, sorry. It's like 8 square miles. So is that a lot of land that's being hit? And just if you could just kind of put that into perspective to the agricultural land in the entire country. Thanks.
Matthew?
Yeah, thanks for the question. So it's indeed, we want to build up to the point where anybody that is displaced and in need of support, food assistance, their needs can be met. So at the moment, worst case scenario, that's going up to 1 million people a day. Right now, we are able, just as the World Food Programme, to serve around 150,000 people each day. There are other partners in the food sector that bring that number up in excess of 200,000, but we've got a long way to go. And the numbers rose so quickly. So there is a lot to be done and a lot more people than we are currently able to reach. And and actually know exactly where they are. A lot of that's to do with the fact that when people have not gone to areas that they are yet registered to receive support, we are having to chase them down and find them in order to see who is most vulnerable and who needs that support. In addition to that 150,000, I should mention there is also cash programming. So we have been able to provide 45,000 people with a cash transfer as well. So it is rising, but we are playing catch up. In terms of the agricultural land damaged through burning, and that's through white phosphorus, that's through other missiles and explosions that have lit up land. What is very significant in the south is the long-term impact. The long-term impact in particular, because a lot of the land which has been targeted is olive farms, and the olive trees are decades, if not more, old, and they will take many, many, many years to be productive once again if the forests have to be replanted and grown. So it's in the grand scheme of things, it's not a huge territory at this point, but it's the long-term impact, because replacing them will take decades.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Can you hear me? Thank you. Thank you for that. Those answers. You also mentioned you've got extraordinary concern for Lebanon's ability to continue to feed itself. Is Lebanon facing a food crisis right now, or is it in the sort of what kind of time horizon? If the things continue the way they are now, will Lebanon be facing a serious food crunch?
So. Typically, in terms of food stocks in the country, depending on the commodity, there's between 2 weeks and 2.5 months of stock. So while there are stocks available, the bigger issue is for the families that have been made homeless, have been dispossessed, have lost their livelihoods, their jobs, their income, and can't actually afford to procure and buy the food that is available. So we have time. There is time to prevent this. The bigger issue is about people's availability to access, because they can't afford, and because they've lost their own livelihoods and homes and means to afford what is available.
Thank you very much. Any other question in the room? No. So let's go to the platform. I'll start with John Zarokostas, France 24. John, good morning.
Yes, good morning. I've got a couple of questions. First, to the representative from WHO in Lebanon, Mr. Clark. Okay, can you give us some more details, sir? The names of the four hospitals that have been partially evacuated, and you said five are not functioning. So is that a total of 9 hospitals that are out of service? If you can send us the name of each hospital and how they've been impacted. And I've got a question concerning to any of the participants. Is there deconfliction in place between the UN agencies and the IDF forces concerning humanitarian movements of aid in Lebanon at the moment? Has that system in place and functioning on a daily basis or not? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ian. I think you have to unmute yourself. You're on.
I thought you were doing it for me. God, sorry, John. I don't have the actual names of the hospitals in case, but I'll follow up through Tariq and make sure that those are shared with you. But just to be clear on the numbers, what we are reporting at the moment is 5 hospitals are reported non-functional now, and then 4 hospitals are semi-functional. So in the case of non-functional, these hospitals are no longer able to work, and that could be through a number of reasons, either because the healthcare workers are no longer there and have evacuated, or they're in areas which are impacted by the fighting in the south, and therefore the ministry has deemed them to evacuate. And then the four hospitals that are semi-functional, these are the hospitals where the ministry has removed all of the chronically ill patients on cancer dialysis and receiving medicines for chronic illnesses. And those patients have been moved to other referral hospitals, but they remain partially functional for immediate trauma care. So they're being more focused onto the trauma care. Now, again, the five that are non-functional, this doesn't mean those five hospitals have been targeted or have been destroyed through bombing. And where those have happened, and again, I don't have the specifics, we do report that within the WHO attack on healthcare system. So that detail is available online for colleagues who would like to look at. And maybe I think Matthew, because you know he's been here longer and was down south earlier on, is probably a better place to talk about deconfliction. We have discussed it with the ministry. They are keen that we declare through the deconfliction process all of the medical facilities. So that's something we are looking to do. But maybe Matthew might say a few words on that as well.
Yes, thank you, Matthew. Maybe on deconfliction or any other colleague from the humanitarian agencies. Matthew.
Thank you. So our colleagues from the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs are working with the agency's funds and programs to put in place and manage on a daily basis the notification procedure to ensure that our movements into frontline areas are notified to the Israeli Defense Forces and all other parties to the conflict, so to ensure safe and consistent humanitarian access. So that notification for movement process is being utilized. The deconfliction process, which is related but slightly different, is for the deconfliction of static sites, so UN and humanitarian facilities. That is also being put in place to ensure that our working space, our working environments are also safe from targeting. It is functioning currently. The difficulty, of course, is with the numbers of missions increasing and the sheer number of teams going out into the field, that's complicated. We are and have consistently advocated for a very significant engagement and investment on making sure deconfliction and notification works. We have had too many issues in the Gaza area of operations where the notification procedure and the deconfliction process has not been respected appropriately. We don't want that to happen in Lebanon, and as such, continue to advocate for the respect for this process, which is covered under international humanitarian law.
I see John has a follow-up.
Yes, I think I need some clarity here. Is the notification and deconfliction between the UN agencies and the IDF forces operational at the moment, or it's in the process of being set up?
It is operational at the moment, John. That's how we're getting into the south and frontline areas and into the south of the Litani.
Very clear, Matthew. Thank you. Gabriela Sotomayor, Proceso.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Alessandra. My question is for WHO or Ian or Matthew. Do you fear that Lebanon could become another Gaza? And are you capable to deal with that scenario? And also I have another question. How is Hezbollah helping their own people? If you can give us some details. Thank you very much.
Who would like to take that? I can't see Ian on the line. I can't see Ian anymore. Matthew, you want to start?
Yeah. So the electricity's just gone off in part of the city, so that might be affecting Ian's connection as well, but our generator's kicked in. The first question, could this be another Gaza, and are we ready for it? Obviously, that's what we would like to avoid. That's why we are consistently and will continue to call for de-escalation and for diplomatic channels to be more successful in terms of ensuring that does not happen. I can tell you that in all of my missions to shelters in Beirut, in the north of the country, but also into areas in the south where people are still being displaced from, that is the concern, that is the fear of every Lebanese citizen that is moving. It's one of the reasons why so many people are moving. They have seen what has happened in Gaza over this past year, and they are fearful that it could happen to them. And, you know, I think from our readiness to respond, you know, we have gone through a great deal of preparedness and anticipation of an unfortunate escalation, which is now being tested. And I think we are able to respond, and we have responded to that test. But clearly, the scale and speed in which people have been displaced because of this current escalation is enormous. And, you know, we will need to ensure that the resources that we've called for in the flash appeal that came out last week are met if we are to do this, because, I mean, quite simply, it's impossible to meet the needs of more than a million people who have been suddenly uprooted, displaced and dispossessed without additional resources coming in. And this was not a country that was well prepared because of all of the challenges that it's faced over the past years. So it's going to be a struggle.
Ian, I see you again on the screen. Would you like to add anything?
Sorry, my connection died and I didn't get the question. So I don't have anything to add unless there's a comeback question.
Okay. And, well, actually, so Gabriella, but no, she's gone. Oh, she's put down her hand. So let's go to Imogen. Imogen Folks, BBC.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for taking my question. It's similar to Gabriella's. It's just that listening to you this morning, I summed up my notes from the UN briefing of about this time last year, maybe a little bit later, November. Forced evacuation, few hours to leave, overcrowded shelters, very few toilets, attacks on healthcare, health workers killed, fears of illnesses related to displacement, lice, scabies, respiratory disease, fears of food shortages. This was all Gaza. And my notes today are almost exactly the same. And I do wonder how you... We've heard a little bit from Matthew about that, you know, the response and you need diplomacy and so on. But, I mean, how are you going to cope if this continues? And it does show no sign of stopping at the moment.
Who would like to answer? Also, the other colleagues online, I repeat, just raise your hand if you want. Matthew, Jan, who wants to take this? Yeah, Matthew, go ahead.
I mean, I spent 6 months as the acting World Food Programme country director in Gaza from January through the end of June this year, before I moved to Lebanon. It is in my mind, from the time I wake until the time I sleep, that we could go into the same sort of spiral of doom, and we need to do everything we can to stop that from happening in this particular crisis. We need the world to be more impactful and able to make the arguments that this cannot go on. I mean, what has happened in Gaza over the past year, what caused or began the Gaza crisis in the first place, that they're all horrific stains on our you know, global conscience, and we shouldn't allow that to happen. But that's for diplomats, that's for politicians to deal and work on in these coming weeks and days and weeks and months. From the humanitarian side, we need to focus on the people who are impacted and to try and provide them with respite, confidence, hope, and their basic needs, and to support the Lebanese, to help the Lebanese at this time. And of that, I am not concerned. I'm not concerned that the agencies, funds, the programs, the international and the national humanitarian actors who are working in Lebanon today, I'm not concerned that they will not be able to do that. We will need resources, we'll need support, but obviously the only logical and humane way to approach this is to prevent and to stop this from getting worse, so that we can actually be spending our time, effort, money, resources on creating a more stable region and stable relationships between those that come from this region.
Thank you very much. I see, Jan, you had open your mic. Is that something you want to add? Oh, he's blocked. I think he's frozen. James, I guess that James is James. Yeah, James, go ahead. So James for UNICEF.
Thanks so much, Alessandra. Hi, everyone. Yeah, I mean, Matthew gets it, nails it. I think, Imogen, though, it's a very, very valid question, and it should be concerning everyone. And it's not like we need to look back 5 years or 10 years for historical precedent. We're still living through that. So if we look at the ferocity of the early attacks, if we look at the language being used, look at the language being used around Rafah, a limited offensive, and Rafah is basically now empty. Look at the mass displacement. Look at the sheer number of people being forced to move. Look at children in all of a sudden in shelters. Look at the lack of safety in shelters, as we see in Gaza. I think shelters or schools in Gaza have been hit 10 times in the last 2 weeks. So the commonalities are everywhere, as our colleague spoke previously around proportionality and force. Look at the sheer overwhelming sense of what's happening in hospitals right now in Lebanon. So the commonalities are unfortunately absolutely there to be seen, whether it is displacement on the ground, impact upon children, or language being used to somewhat soften what the realities are on the ground. And I think that whilst in the last X number of months, it's felt somewhat futile to continue to push for the right thing, which is a ceasefire in Gaza, because of course, a ceasefire, as we all know, gets hostages home. It was that humanitarian pause/ceasefire in late November, early December that got more than 100 hostages home. I don't think more than 10 have been able to get back to Israel in any other form since then. So all those things speak to a ceasefire. But perhaps now more than ever, it's impossible to disentangle these two conflicts. So surely those people with that level of influence, that small handful of people with that influence, know that a ceasefire in Gaza will be key to de-escalating what's occurring now in Lebanon and elsewhere.
I give the floor to Jeremy to also answer, but just Gabriela has put in the chat, in fact, there was a second part to her question, which was about Hezbollah and how they're helping their own people. But Jeremy, maybe you want to answer first this, and then I'll take if anybody can answer the second question from Gabriela.
Yes, thank you. So just to echo more or less what James has just said, it's here we are again in a situation. You talk about Gaza, but the situation is critical today in Lebanon as it is in Gaza. It's there, and there is only one way forward out of this situation, and that is to immediately stop the violence. That will save civilian lives. That will prevent the destruction. At the moment, sadly, our situation is that we are seeing the same patterns that we saw in Gaza, the same means and methods of warfare that have been used. And as a result, we're seeing civilians pay the ultimate price, whether it be the hospitals being closed, a million people displaced, civilians killed, schools impacted. The devastation is beyond belief for all people in Lebanon as it is in Gaza. We can't let this happen again.
Absolutely. Gabriela, did I interpret well what you wanted to ask? And then I'll take Maya's question and then we go to Claire, who's been patiently waiting. Gabriela, is it
yes,
about...
They mentioned about 1 million people displaced. Well, my question on Hezbollah, but what is the estimate of the number of children? If you have any estimate from that million of people that has been displaced? Thank you.
Okay, so maybe if anybody wants to speak about Hezbollah, and then Matthew, and then maybe James on the number of children. Matthew?
I mean, on the Hezbollah question, to be honest with you, Gabriela, I don't know. I'm not sure if any of us knows exactly how Hezbollah is working on supporting its communities or those that it represents. What is clear, of course, is that there's Hezbollah and Hezbollah. There is the Hezbollah, which is a military or a militia, and there is Hezbollah, which has ministers in the government, and the ministry and the government is trying to respond writ large. All ministries are in, you know, emergency mode and are trying to do to continue their work, albeit in very challenging circumstances. But in terms of how Hezbollah is helping in social services, provision, etc., I couldn't tell you. I don't know.
James?
Gabriele, yeah, the estimate is 400,000 children. And unfortunately, yes, as colleagues are speaking, so many parallels to displacements in Gaza, leaving under bombardment, leaving amidst that all the terror that brings, leaving with very few possessions very frequently. That's what we're encountering when families arrive in shelters. And remembering, of course, as you will, Gabriella, and all will, that this already comes on top of a very fragile situation in Lebanon, a whole range of different crises, whether it was COVID, whether it was the explosion, certainly what we've seen and we briefed here before on high increases in the poverty rate in Lebanon for the last 2 years. All those things have added to a layer of stress. And of course, yes, for those 400,000 children no longer sleeping in their homes, things just got immeasurably worse.
Absolutely. Last question from Maya Plans, David Brief.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my question, Alessandra. My question is for James. I'm seeing here this surveillance system for attacks on healthcare, this database that the World Health Organization has. Does UNICEF has anything similar in terms of the attacks you suffer when you are delivering services and goods to the populations in distress?
Sorry, one more time. Does UNICEF have anything similar to what in terms of delivering to populations?
To the WHO? Go ahead, Maya.
Sorry, yeah, it is. The World Health Organization has a database where they compile the number of attacks they receive when they are trying to deliver services in conflict zones or other distressful situations. Do you have something similar at UNICEF that we could take a look at? Perhaps you don't have the answer right now, but it's called the Tariq put it in the chat next to the Zoom call, and it's called, for the World Health Organization, the database is called Surveillance System for Attacks on Healthcare. So they compile the numbers. So for instance, yesterday, they have time unknown confirmed that there were X amount of times that convoys or people trying to deliver goods or services were attacked. And then the resulting deaths, so injuries and
I think we know which one you're referring to, Maya. James, do you have anything similar?
No, Liz, I might, Tariq can clarify, or our colleague in Lebanon can clarify, but of course, because of WHO's mandate, so they would be talking about healthcare workers, healthcare facilities, So I do understand that database. For UNICEF, any attacks on UNICEF vehicles, UNICEF staff would always be coordinated through OCHA, who would have a who have an ongoing tally, whether we are talking about in Afghanistan, Ukraine, Gaza or Lebanon. So not our own individual database. No, it would be coordinated through the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs.
Yeah, thank you. I absolutely. And I see Jan nodding. Jeremy, look clear. It's okay? Okay, sorry. We have a last, after the last question by Jeremy Lange, Radio France Internationale.
A quick one, I promise, for WFP. Yeah, it's open. It's open. A quick one for WFP. You mentioned the land that was burned and abandoned in the south of Lebanon. I was just wondering, can you cope? I mean, can the north of Lebanon cope with what's been left in the south? I mean, basically all the food is coming at the airport in Beirut. So how much surface do you have left basically in the north?
Matthew?
Thanks, Jeremy. No, farming, agriculture, whether it's dairy farming or cattle rearing for meat or vegetables, olives, all forms of farming in the remainder of the country continue. But we have lost a very significant amount in terms of the south that fed the population of the south and was also exported. To create, or to provide the living for farmers in the south. So it is very much an impact on southerners, on one part of the community that makes up Lebanon. When you look at basic commodities into the country is still very much reliant on imports for things like wheat, for bread, et cetera. And that still needs to come from outside. So what we've lost in the south and what we continue to lose are the citrus orchards, the banana plantations, the olive trees that aren't being harvested, the olive trees which have now burnt down in the hinterland, and all of the vegetable growing areas. That's definitely a big concern when you are looking at what we hope will be a return of farmers to their land in as soon as possible, as soon as this can be de-escalated, but returning to what? And in many cases, they will be returning to land which is not farmable for many years to come.
Thank you very much. Jan, sorry, you wanted to add something?
Sorry, my connection went. I just wanted to go back very quickly to the question that Imogen from BBC.
We lost you again. Go ahead, try, but we lost you. I don't know if, no, I think he's... Jan, I'm sorry, but you come completely broken. Maybe you can just ask Tariq or send an answer to Imogen directly, because we can't hear you, sorry. I'm sorry. And before we leave this the subject of the Middle East, just wanted to tell you two things. First of all, I think it's really important to remind that the plan, the Lebanon Flash Appeal, that some of the speakers referred to today is only funded 12.1%. This is 51.4 million. So 87.9% need to be funded. It's very important to remind you. And the other thing I wanted to say is that at 6:45 p.m. Geneva time, the Secretary General is expected to hold a media stakeout in New York, which, of course, you can watch on Web TV. And he's expected to speak about the Middle East and take a few questions. So thank you very much to all our speakers here and in Beirut. Good luck with this so important work. I'll turn now to Claire for her briefing. Claire, you're going to tell us about hurricanes. The weather outside is not just hurricanes, but it's really bad.
It's pretty wet. It's pretty
so let's wet. Hear about the hurricane season.
Yes, so good morning, everybody. So turning to our weather and climate, we're also running out of adjectives, unfortunately. We're hearing words such as unprecedented, catastrophic, historic, record-breaking more and more to describe what we're seeing with the weather. We're now in October. This is after the historic peak of the Atlantic hurricane season. And yet today we're seeing all the reports about Hurricane Milton, which is posing an extremely serious threat to Florida, which obviously is a state which is still reeling from the devastation of Hurricane Helene less than 2 weeks ago. And Hurricane Helene caused a death toll of more than 160. Milton, according to the latest forecasts from the U.S. National Hurricane Center, will likely make landfall in Florida Wednesday night, local time. The maximum sustained winds at the moment are 250 kilometers an hour, and this is a powerful Category 4. Milton sort of reached a Category 5 yesterday, and the National Hurricane Center is saying that, you know, fluctuations in the strength are likely, but whatever, regardless, Milton, and I quote, is forecast to remain an extremely dangerous hurricane through landfall in Florida. As we've seen with a number of tropical cyclones recently, Milton intensified at an explosive rate. It was very, very fast. Again, this is an increasingly common occurrence. We saw it with Hurricane Beryl at the start of the year. We saw it with the major hurricane which hit Acapulco last year, that hurricanes suddenly go from tropical storm status to whoomph, you know, major hurricane status in a matter of hours. According to the US National Hurricane Center, it was the third most rapid intensification in the Atlantic Basin. Why? As we've said before, ocean heat is playing a role. Warm sea surface temperatures provide the energy that hurricane needs for growth. The deeper the heat, the more energy a storm can draw. In the Gulf of Mexico and Florida area, we are seeing, you know, very warm ocean waters at the moment. Another factor to bear in mind, Milton is a large hurricane. Hurricane force winds extend outwards up to 45 kilometers, 30 miles, and it's expected to grow in size. So that means its impacts will be expanded. It might weaken in intensity, but, you know, the impacts will be larger, a wider area. The U.S. National Hurricane Center and the National Weather Service, obviously, who are both members of the World Meteorological Organization, are warning that a large area of destructive storm surge will occur along parts of the west coast of Florida, and that this is an extremely life-threatening situation. In the Tampa Bay area, which is quite a built-up area, the National Weather Service is predicting a storm surge of about 10 to 15 feet. That's huge. If you look at the illustrations, you know, you compare that to a house size, you know, it gets it in proportion, the danger and the risks of this hurricane. We're expecting also very, very heavy rainfall, which will exacerbate the situation. Important to bear in mind that this is the state of Florida, but the trajectory of Milton compared to Helene is different. Milton is going to cross Florida, whereas Helene sort of meandered upwards, you know, through the Carolinas and got stuck there. Milton is following a similar track to Hurricane Ian, which caused devastation 2 years ago in Florida, and Ian also peaked as a Category 5. There are currently three hurricanes spinning in the Atlantic. Milton, we've just heard about, Leslie, somewhere in the middle of the Atlantic, and Kirk, which we in Europe are going to hear about in the next couple of days. Kirk is heading towards Europe from you know, from the US. It's currently a Category 1 status. It will weaken and become what in the meteorological community is called an extra-tropical cyclone, or an ex-tropical cyclone. The forecast tracks have varied in the past couple of days. The latest forecast has that the major impacts will be in France, and Météo France is forecasting that Kirk will be a dangerous storm, wind gusts of up to 100 kilometers an hour, and very, very heavy rainfall. That's it. Sorry, I will send you the notes after this. We were compiling it until I came on.
Yeah, pretty worrying situation, Jamie.
Hello, Claire. Thank you for that. Is there any way to interpret the decline from Category 5 to a Category 4? Is that indicative of anything in terms of the trend line? You mentioned that the swath of land that's going to be affected is clearly going to be broad, but in terms of the intensity, is there any way to sort of interpret the trend line? And then my second question is, of course, Milton here has started sort of in the western part of the Caribbean over, you know, off of Mexico. I'm being naive here, but I always thought that the hurricanes traditionally would come from sort of the Atlantic side more. So is there anything unusual about that?
So in terms of the, you know, the variation in intensity, there's all sorts of things that happen. You know, eye wall replacement, so it temporarily weakens. And as the National Hurricane Center has said, you know, they do expect some, you know, some fluctuations. But regardless, it will remain a very dangerous hurricane. And the trend that we are seeing is this trend towards, you know, very rapid intensification. In terms of the tracks, I need to look at the historic tracks from the National Hurricane Center. I don't think there's anything exceptional about this track, but I will check. Just to give you an idea, I mean, we at the World Meteorological Organization, we work very, very closely with the, you know, weather forecasting community. There is one veteran US weather sort of hurricane presenter. His name is John Morales. He's been doing this for decades. And he actually broke down in tears yesterday making his regular report. He's so emotional about what he's seeing. And this is a guy who's seen dozens and dozens and dozens of hurricanes.
It speaks about it. Nina.
Hi, Claire. The fact that these are happening so late in the season, do you think that is this sort of a, can we expect this to be like a new normal in terms of how these hurricanes are going to happen going forward?
I think the new normal is the abnormal. I think that's what we're learning. It has been an unusual season. So Hurricane Beryl, which was back in July, so quite early on in the season. That was record-breaking because it was the earliest Hurricane 5, Category 5 Atlantic hurricane on record. These are, you know, very late Category 5 hurricanes. The historic peak tends to be late August, September, because of the warm ocean waters. And as I said, you know, the waters around Florida are still very, very warm. It remains to be seen. We have seen Category 5 hurricanes in October, so it's not the first one, and it certainly won't be the last.
Thank you very much. No more questions in the room. Gabriela?
Thank you, Alessandra. Hi, Claire. Do you expect heavy rain or something in Mexico, in parts of Mexico? Could you talk about that?
Yes, I'm just looking at the latest forecast from the National Hurricane Center. So today, They're warning of damaging hurricane force winds and life-threatening storm surge with destructive waves across portions of the northern coast of the Yucatan Peninsula. So I'm just trying to look at the map. So
Yes, so Mexico will be impacted, but it seems to be, you know, it seems to be on the edge. The main impacts are going to be in Florida.
Thank you very much, Clara. Oh, Maya.
Yes, thank you for taking my question, Alessandra. Hello, Claire. My question is related to the weather systems in the Amazon rainforest. If there is any research that has indicated that there is some relationship between these extreme weather events occurring at this time of the year and the Amazon rainforest fires.
I would have to check on that. I think our Secretary General Celeste Saulo, you know, tried to answer questions yesterday on what's happening in the Amazon. I'm not aware immediately of a direct correlation, but having said that, you know, most weather patterns are, you know, there are lots of teleconnections, as we call them. But I would have to check and get back to you on that. I mean, the, you know, this is related to the hurricane season rather than, you know, what's happening elsewhere with the climate.
Don't see any other hand for Claire. Oh, no, Maya has a follow-up.
Yes, thank you, Claire, for the clarification. And if we could follow up then on that. And also the question was related, but do you see also if there is an increase in the severity of this? I know it's the season and there are category 5 hurricanes every once and then, but is there any indication also in the research looking at a 30-year period that the severity of the number of hurricanes that hit the Gulf Coast have increased in the last 30 years, as a follow-up question.
Yeah, I mean, as we said in the World Meteorological Organization State Water Resources report that we released yesterday, because of climate change, the hydrological cycle is accelerating. It's becoming more erratic, spinning out of control, so to speak. So that means that we are seeing more intense rainfall, more extreme droughts. That's just in, you know, that's just in general. A warmer atmosphere holds more moisture. So when it does rain, that rainfall, you know, has a tendency to be heavier because of heat. Droughts are becoming, you know, more intense. All of that was in the report yesterday. Because of sea level rise, we are seeing greater impacts from storm surge, which, you know, is a major hazard from tropical cyclones. And the research from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change indicates that whilst we will not necessarily see an increase in the overall number of tropical cyclones, we are likely to see an increase in the proportion of very intense tropical cyclones. And what we have seen, certainly this year, last year, is a tendency towards more rapid intensification.
Gabriela is asking if you can repeat the name of the anchor that broke on tears, speaking about Milton, the anchorman.
Right. Yes, sorry, the anchorman, I can send you his name in the chat. His name is John Morales. He actually made it onto the front page of the Bild newspaper in Germany today with the the title in German is "Weather Expert Battles with Tears," as he reads out the forecast. So his name is John Morales. He's very well known. He's very respected. He won a Lifetime Achievement Award last year, along with WMO Secretary General Celeste Saulo of the American Meteorological Society. So, you know, this is somebody he knows. He knows his stuff.
He knows what he's talking about. Maya, last follow up.
Yes, thank you very much. The last question is related to the early warning systems. I've seen that for Eileen, that the early warning systems were working quite well and people were able to move out of the danger zones. Is there anything that you can comment on in terms of early warning systems that are put in place by the U.S. government and the Hurricane Center in Miami in relation to Milton? Thank you.
The forecasts and the early warnings, as we saw with Helene, were excellent. They are excellent, very, very accurate, very precise for Milton. What we're seeing is, you know, the National Hurricane Center, the National Weather Service will be issuing the forecasts and the warnings, and then it's obviously for local authorities, for authorities in Florida to act on those, to issue the evacuation orders. It's not always easy. You know, roads are clogged. There's probably, you know, no more availability on flights. And what Professor Saulo said yesterday, that in the case of Helene, you know, the warnings were there, but in many cases, because people had never experienced anything like it, they couldn't actually believe it, so they didn't act on those warnings. We're hoping that this will be different with Milton, and this particular area where it's meant to make landfall, that was hit by Hurricane Ian 2 years ago. So, you know, we're hoping that the memories of Hurricane Ian and of Hurricane Helene will be fresh enough so that people do act on the warnings and evacuate or stay safe.
Thank you very much, Claire, for all this information. Just a few announcements to conclude. First of all, let me remind you that the 9th of October, the international community celebrates the World Post Day. This year is a particular year because we are also celebrating the 150th anniversary of the Universal Postal Union. 150 is a big age. But as the Secretary General say in the message that we have distributed to you, the UPU, being also one of the earliest examples of multilateralism in action, it continues to leverage new technologies to provide essential services to humanity. You have the full message in your mailbox. I've been asked by WTO to remind you of an upcoming WTO embargoed press conference. This is on the Global Trade Outlook and Statistics October update, and it's going to take place at the WTO on the 10th of October, so in 2 days at 2 p.m. Geneva time. So the event will be at WTO in room D, and it will also available via Zoom. Please note that the embargo will be lifted at 3 p.m. Geneva time on the same day. An embargoed copy of the report and news item will be available today from 4 p.m. on the WTO online media newsroom. And if you wish to participate either virtually or in person, please get in contact with the WTO media team. Fernando gave us this information, so you can address him if you have further questions. A very, very last point, the Committee on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, that, as you know, has started its session, that's the 89th session, is reviewing today the report of the Lao People's Democratic Republic. The other countries to follow will be Saudi Arabia, New Zealand, Chile, Canada, Japan, Cuba, and Benin. And the work will conclude on the 25th of October. That's what I had for you. Is there any other question? I don't see any. So thank you very much to everyone for following this press briefing. Thanks to our briefers, and I'll see you on Friday. Thanks.